Hello. Hello and welcome. Two men known for several appearances on Top of the Pops. Their involvement in a show that has twice been voted quite simply the best programme on radio, and stars of their own award-winning TV comedy show. Today, I'm in conversation with Tim Brooke-Taylor and Graham Garden. Guys, the obvious first question I have to ask you, which will not mean a lot to the radio listeners, but never seen you sitting on the same bench before. Here you are side by side. How does it feel?
That's true, yes. Yes,
we're long-term opponents, aren't we?
Yes,
really?
We are. Yeah. Yes, I'm slightly worried about it.
I noticed Graham grabbed that seat when we did the rehearsal, grabbed the downstage seat.
It's a quick getaway seat.
That's what it is. Fast exit.
Okay, so back to Cambridge. Back to Cambridge. Not for you, not for me. Back to Cambridge. 1960, Tim goes up to read law. Graham, you come up in 61 to study medicine. In what is at that point presumably the funniest place in the universe, Peter Cook, arguably the funniest man in the later half of the 20th century, has just left. Beyond the Fringes, storming around the world, making a huge impression. Did it feel as if you were at the cradle of...
Well, I don't think it's arguable. I think Peter Cook was the funniest person. And when I got there, he just left the term before. Timing. It's all timing. And Beyond the Fringe came through Cambridge when I was there. And I booked 10 seats for the first night and 10 seats for the last night, because my brother had told me he was funny. And I couldn't sell the first 10 seats, but I could have sold the last lot at the end of the week for about 20 times as much. Still the funniest thing I've ever seen. Hit my head on the seat in front. I mean, it was so funny. Just wonderful.
You saw it, Graham?
I didn't, no, because, as you say, I came up a year after Tim. Whether we felt it that we were moving into the cradle of comedy, I think we were moving into a very hard act to follow.
Yeah. But at that particular time, the Footlights wasn't known. I mean, it wasn't a thing you went there to be a Footlight. Nowadays, I think they go there mini-professionals at the age of 18.
Well, I was going to say, did you... I mean, tell me honestly now, did you actually go up to read those subjects, or did you kind of think, you know, into Footlights, bit of comedy, into Radio 4?
Well, certainly, as far as I'm concerned, I didn't remotely think about it. I went there to study law, because that's what my family all do, and could earn a crust. But the big thing was, in my case, it was the Education Committee of Derbyshire, who, God bless them, who gave me the grant. And they asked this question, what are you going to do when you're not working? Now, I prepared a pretty good answer of how hard I was going to work. I hadn't prepared what I was going to do when I wasn't working. So I blurted out the Footlights, because my brother had been there a few years before.
And had he been in the Footlights, in fact?
He had. Not interested in the... He was in the club, and if you understand what I'm talking about. And I just blurted out. When I got there, they were all far too smart and clever and witty, and I didn't dare do it. And I auditioned for a play in my college, 33 parts, 34 people auditioned, and I failed to get a part.
So, Graham had a similar problem. You didn't actually join the Footlights first. You joined Curls.
Yeah, I didn't dare join the Footlights. Mm. I was daunted by them. And I'd seen the review my first year when I went up there, and I thought, these are, you know, very funny, very good people. I can't do that. I'd been in one school play, you know.
But so what did you do?
Well, I joined CULES, which is the Cambridge University Light Entertainment Society. Several of them were members of the Footlights, but they used to go around doing charity gigs. We would perform in prisons and hospitals and mental hospitals. And that was a very, very good training. And after a sort of year doing that, I thought, well, I think I might even dare to face the fearsome Footlights.
And they didn't come and try and poach you, Graham. You did have to still go.
Oh, no, I had to push to get in. And I was terrified of the president, who was Tim.
Yes, well, of course. Yeah, Tim, you joined in 62 and you did, I think that year was a show called Double Take.
Yes.
Which wasn't a bad little collection of talent. Directed by Trevor Nunn. Starred yourself.
What happened to him? Yeah.
John Cleese, Graham Chapman, Miriam Margolis, and Tony Hendra, who then went to America and founded the hugely successful National Lampoon. Was it clear that they were all going to be megastars?
No, we weren't going to be stars at all. We were going to go back to law and teach. I mean,
you really still were at this point?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we were just doing that. It was fun, and you'd go and do a proper job.
Okay, so one year you're now president, and the new show, can you remember what it was called?
It was called Cambridge Circus.
Yes, but before that.
Oh, it was called Clump of Plinth.
A Clump of Plinth.
Yes,
almost.
I think I liked Clump and John Cleese liked Plinth, and we compromised.
Who liked Ov?
So this is you, Cleese, Chapman, Bill Oddie had joined by now.
Yes.
David Hatch and Joe Kendall, and as you say, that went on to become a worldwide success. You played Australia, New Zealand, I think.
New Zealand, yes. We didn't play Australia. We might have lost that. We went to New Zealand where we had a terrific time there. They didn't have a clue who we were, quite rightly, because we hadn't been anywhere. And there was a Kerry Jodians were putting us on, and we went around the place, and suddenly we became a very popular. It was a time when New Zealand, I think, is a great country now, but it was dead then. And it was you'd get the pubs would shut at six. Vic Oliver, who was a great comedian, went out to Christchurch, and they said, well, "What do you think of Christchurch?" And he said, "It's beautifully laid out. How long has it been dead?" And that was what it was like. I remember going into a pub, it was shut at six, and so they're like a glass of wine. You could see all these faces. Who's this pufter that's just come in? Now, of course, they produce the best possible wine in the
Absolutely.
World. Yeah. But you go down to breakfast, and they say, tea, do you take sugar? And you say, well, no. Well, don't steer it, then.
I'm coming back. I've not left Graham out. I'm coming back to Graham, but just one last question. This, as you say, Cambridge Circus played the West End, played Broadway. Well reviewed, good reviews in the West End?
Yes, actually. Very good indeed. I can't remember them. I'm not that sad. But
Bernard Levin.
Oh, yeah, Bernard Levin was wonderful. He went through about how Rabbit's Friends and Relations, which meant obviously friends were there but clapping, and none of us were over nine, and there were no names to ever, you know, be like Jonathan Miller. There'd be no new names. There was, in fact, John Cleese, Graham Chapman, myself, Bill Oddie, and on and on.
So you keep that one,
I keep that one, Tim. And I'm very proud of it. Bless him.
Well, meanwhile, festering away in Cambridge, you've now not only got to follow Peter Cook and Beyond the Fringe, but probably arguably the most successful Footlights show ever, Graham, as you take over your presidency in 64.
Yes, it was hell.
What did you do?
We did a review called Stuff What Dreams Are Made Of.
Not quite the success of Cambridge Circus.
No, in no way. Not at all. But it was very good fun. We did a tour in this country. We did Edinburgh. And then I went on to be a medical student and left Cambridge, went to London to King's College Hospital.
So you did actually start to practice. Did you fully qualify? Are you a qualified doctor?
I'm qualified, but I've never practiced.
But you could. I mean,
I could. So if these people don't keep me employed doing what I'm doing now, I may appear at the end of your bed one day.
Horrible thought. So you're now just about to start practice as a doctor. Tim's back from worldwide success. And 64, we see the start of a groundbreaking, much-loved, much-remembered show. I'm sorry, I'll read that again. How did that come about?
Well, the very first, the Cambridge Circus we mentioned, we did three shows based on that, and they thought, well, maybe have to do four more, and we thought we'd better have another title. And it was, I'm sorry, I read that again. And it was basically what we were doing anyway and allowed to do on radio.
Let's have a little listen to Tim at 23 years old. He is in this clip.
See what you make of this one, Herbie.
Oh, it's enchanting. A little playful, perhaps, but not extravagant, no. It has a certain, I don't know what, a certain je ne sais quoi. Now, unless I'm very much mistaken, it's a claret.
You are very much mistaken.
Of course I am. Of course I'm. Silly me. Of course it's not a claret. It's not nearly sinful enough for a claret. No, it is in fact, a burgundy? Yes, that's it, a burgundy. A very fine, full-bodied, red burgundy. A killing little Chambon Musigny. No, it's pretty badly bottled, I'm afraid. So it probably came from the Leblanc vineyard. Poor old Lucien Leblanc, who was passed it even in 53. Now, I remember his wife saying, poor old Lucien always bottles so badly because he's always so badly bottled. I nearly died. Beautiful woman. Beautiful woman, his wife, a marvellously full-bodied, mature 38 vintage with a lovely nose.
It goes on to turn out the wine actually is a piece of steak. But I don't know, hearing things afterwards is very odd.
It is funny because you know when you see pictures of yourself, yeah. When you hear the voice, it's so telling, isn't it?
I sounded frightened and slightly camp.
Never.
Never let it be said. Never let it be said. That series ran through till 73, I think about 8 series. Graham, when did you join it?
I think it was the series after the first series, which was based on Cambridge Circus. And Graham Chapman had to drop out of the cast because he was doing his, not medical studies, I think he was actually practising then as a houseman,
wasn't he?
Yes. So I sort of stepped in to take his place. And I was still a medical student. And Humphrey Barclay was producing, or co-producing at the time, and they asked if I would join in and perform and do some writing.
And the writing became critical, because by the end of the run, you and Bill were pretty well writing it.
Eventually, Bill and I wrote most of it, yeah.
After about 4 or 5 years, quite a long time after, actually. And they wrote some wonderful... The trouble with Graham was he used to write these wonderful scripts, parodies, and would say, what's the script? Oh, Graham hasn't... He's delivering babies in Plymouth. And, you know, what sort of professional is that?
Just listening again to them last week, some of the early series, there was a kind of goonness about them. There was a kind of mad... create your own world. I was listening to an investigation of Jack the Ripper, which reminded me very much of Spike. I mean, was that a conscious...
You don't consciously. I was never a huge fan of the Goon Show, I have to say. And there's some brilliant things. I used to write for Spike in 64 or 5. And the great thing about writing for Spike is that you'd write something beginning, middle and end, because you didn't put too many jokes in because you didn't like jokes. So I wrote one, for example, which was about a council house, and there was a peer of the realm who was living in this council house, and he wore all the full regalia, and he used to shoot the ducks off the walls and things like that. And it was all a beginning and middle end, nothing very much, but Spike would put in brilliant things. He'd suddenly be walking around and a butler would come out of the cupboard and say, time for your heart attack, sir.
Which you just put in rehearsal, wasn't
well, he? That's his genius.
Graham, were you a Goons fan?
I was. I was at private school, and we used to listen to it sort of as a ritual every week. And I think, you know, we were never trying to copy the Goons, but what happens is that you learn what your sense of humour is, you find things funny, and then you work out how they work. That joke works because it's misdirecting the audience in that way, and so you learn how to copy the way that jokes work.
Certainly, by you listen to later series, you can much more hear pre-echoes of the Goodies rather than back echoes from the Goon Show.
What one forgets is very heavy censorship. You could hardly say anything. Of course, things like Round the Horn got filthier and filthier because they weren't allowed to use the word dwarf, so they did Snow White and the Seven Jockeys. They wrote it as that, and it was doubly funny. And ours got filthier and filthier because they kept saying we couldn't do that.
I think it's a great shame that the censorship is being lightened.
I think double entendre is one of the funniest forms of humour, but we were driven to it. I mean, we were driven to it.
We used to have a live band on the show, and occasionally you'd have a producer who would cut a joke, and you'd say, why are you cutting that joke? And he'd say, because the band laughed.
That was the measure.
That was it.
Actually, I just want to ask you one more thing about... I'm sorry. Of course, Cleese involved, but... one senses even on air a distancing. Was that the truth?
Well, not distancing as a person, because I went, at the same time as we were doing this, I was doing at last the 1948 show with him and writing things. In fact, several of the Python sketches came from that. I won my battle. The Four Yorkshiremen, for example, was the 1948 show. And we were going along the same route. I think it's quite possible that I might have been in Python. I just happened to be working with Marty Feldman at the time.
This is one of the, I think, one of the most interesting questions, because, you know, at this point I was still very young. Very young fan watching it all at home.
So how old does that make me feel?
I have no idea.
I'm very happy to be here.
No, and of course... I do remember the 1948 show, because like all those shows, we found it very quickly. And so when Python came later, we kind of almost expected it from that team. But of course, the amazing thing about the 1948 show, it did have really the essence, the seminal moment of both Python and the Goodies.
Yeah.
Was that, was it clear even working on, because you did two series, I think, in about 67?
We did, yes, that's exactly right. And it was one of those things that I was asked to do a series, and I said, I can't do it on my own, so I asked John, and then we got Graham, and then Marty Feldman was working with us. I remember David Frost actually put it on. He said, no, you can't have Marty, people won't like his eyes, because it was his fortune. But we were doing a lot of it, you know, had come via I'm Sorry and that sort of thing. It's the way we were working, and our sense of humour was typical and went on from there. But the extraordinary thing was, as you say, people found it very quickly. It went out at 10:30 at night, and suddenly they realised that it was good and put it out at 8. Sadly, half the country never saw it. You can still get a very grainy black and white version of
it. Well, I was going to say that it's one of those legendary white shows, isn't it?
Well, like Graham and I did Broaden Your Mind, which is a series I was very fond of. That's been wiped as well, but fortunately in Australia there's some wonderful people who somehow have got a soundtrack of that.
So they went their way, you went yours. Where did the Goodies come from? What did somebody ask? Did you go to them?
I think it came through the show that Tim was talking about, Broaden Your Mind. Everybody seemed to be working on things. There was Do Not Adjust Your Set with Eric Idle and Mike Palin, Terry Jones and co.
That was an ITV show as well, I think.
Yes, it was. And Tim and I were kind of the only two left at the loose end, well, almost.
Well, I was asked to do a series after Marty, and I wanted a chum to do it with, and it was Eric Idle that suggested Graham. You were sharing a flat or something.
We were, yeah.
And Bill?
Bill came in later as singing a song each week, and then a bit more. And then we were asked after the second series. They liked it, but something slightly different. So we said, OK, we'll go away and write something different. And we wrote the goodies. And I think we never handed it in. It was a fait accompli. And I don't think it would have ever got past the idea of three guys who did anything anytime anyway. It's not a great subject.
Well, the show about nothing, you know.
Yes,
I mean, Seinfeld's got away with it. And you guys, that was the premise, really. And we would do anything.
At the time, Python was up and running. And we were doing a sketch show. So we were in the same kind of area. If we were going to move in any direction, it would have been closer to what Python was doing. And we thought, well, why don't we do something that is different, i.e. do the same sort of silly humour that we were doing in four-minute sketches, stretched into a half-hour storyline.
It was to avoid the punchline, because Python were brilliant. They just had Grant Chapman coming and say, this is getting silly, let's go and do something else.
So you guys had to, of course, put the pressure on you to create a punchline.
Yes, that's right.
And you got around it another way.
We got around it another way by having regular characters.
From pretty early on, it was a hugely visual show. You're talking about the differences with Python. For all the brilliance of Python, and indeed some of the cartoon creations, but yours was a show that very early on really set new standards, found new boundaries for television visual effects and design and film techniques and so on. Was that something that you got interested in, or was that a reaction to not wanting to be...
I remember the Footlights. We had a comedy film night, and we were trying to get Buster Keaton's The General, and we got another one, and we were just dumbfounded by this brilliant comedian. I mean, he's modern now. Chaplin, so funny. And so a lot of those visual ideas, we were all agreed. We also liked cartoons. I love Bugs Bunny and things. There was so much invention.
I mean, that's very interesting, because when I remember in the very early script stages of Young Ones, we used to absolutely use the Roadrunner and so on, Tom and Jerry as the reference for the violence in Young Ones. It was cartoon violence. Are you a big cartoon fan, Graham?
Absolutely, yes. And we'd always get blown up and end up, you know, sort of smoking covered in black soot and stuff. And we actually recreated some of the Buster Keaton stuff, like the house falling on.
And he goes through the window.
And he goes through the window. But all three of us went through the window. So fairly scary, trying to find the mark on the ground.
Where this thing will or not hit you,
The nicest thing that people ever say is, you look as if you were enjoying yourself. I can tell you we weren't. It's the most painful. We were always ending up in hospital with things. It was
seriously dangerous.
We were so stupid. We did it. You know, we didn't get somebody else to do it for us. We did it and hurt ourselves.
Sadly, I never worked on the show, but by this time I was at the Beeb. You knew when the goodies was in production, because it seemed the whole weight of the BBC used to gear up in the best sense that it was then capable of, these huge sets. The whole visual effects department would be given over. You'd be going to get a little mousetrap or something for a Two Ronnie sketch, and the whole place would be full of organs and cannons, and the goodies were in production again.
I'm actually very proud of all that, because actually it was quite cheap. What we did was we sat down, we had a great director, Jim Franklin, who did a storyboard of all the filming thing, and we would sit around a big table with wardrobe, visual effects, etc., and we would work out what was the cheapest, and we'd bargain, and they'd say, well, I'm afraid that joke costs £45, and we'd say, okay, we won't do that, but can we do that? We worked very hard. All this bit about, oh, they just spent money, we worked so hard. By the end of every series, we'd run out of money, so we had to do one in the office with our normal clothes, which were usually the best shows. In fact, though, you talk about the Young Ones, they were very much Young Ones type shows.
It was expensive, it was not extravagant, I think is the point, that we did plan it very carefully so that all the resources appeared on the screen.
Yeah.
And that's quite important.
What people tend to forget is it was a show for 10:30 at night. That's what it was. What happened was that parents saw it and thought, oh, our kids would like that. And then BBC made a big mistake and thought it was a kids show. A bit like The Simpsons. The BBC still thinks The Simpsons is a kids show. Kids don't understand The Simpsons. It's far too adult for them.
Well, I think that's really interesting as well, because I think you're right. I think the kind of... headline stereotypical thought would be that Python was this dangerous late night wacky thing, and the goodies was almost a children's show or an evening show. But in fact, I think it's right in saying that you were banned in South Africa and the Pythons never were.
That's right, we were banned
in this country.
You
did have censorship problems.
Censorship problems. But we were I don't know, I think people who are young when they're young in the 70s will be surprised at how adult the programme is. I mean, I know people come up to me now and say, I saw a goodies video and I didn't realised there were two levels to it, and I don't wish to overestimate that, but it's, well, as you know, it goes out in Australia, and there it goes out 5 days a week, and it's as popular as it ever was.
I must say, researching for this, you've got a fantastic Australian website, which I'm sure you guys know about.
Absolutely.
But I mean,
brilliant. It's, and they're all very bright. And
Alison Bean.
Yes, absolutely.
Give her a mention on the radio.
Do you know the address offhand for fans?
Goody's Rule OK is the actual thing, yes.
Just before we leave, Graham, the writing developed, as you say, on I'm sorry, I'll read that again, all of you contributed, but I think it's fair to say that for one reason or another, by the end of the Goodies, again, it was you and it was Graham and Bill.
Yeah.
What happened, Tim? Did you opt out, Graham? Did you just go too quick for him? What happened?
We had the pen. no, I think, as you say, at the end, it was Bill and I wrote it, Tim in an editorial capacity, if you like. We all used to get together, all three of us, for a big sort of day's meeting before writing started. And talk through ideas and then put two unlikely ideas together and think of a way to parody both in the same show. And then Bill and I would go away and write it. And Tim, meanwhile, was that you were actually performing in other series.
Hello, Cheeky, and things like that, yes. Yeah. They're better writers than me. They write quicker than I do. But I think what was very important was the first bit when we discussed. The Ecky Thump one, for example, which is, people haven't seen it, we're all northerners, actually, and we thought we'd do the flat caps and all that. Then we, a bit of Eisenstein film came in somewhere around the line, and then there was Kung Fu, that's right. So you can put them together, so you can do sketches on each of them. And that's one that...
And you'd all sit around the table and generate those ideas.
Those ideas, yes.
And then you rather cleverly would go off and do a few more free-paying jobs while the boys got on.
Well, they got paid for it more than I did. But it was quite useful for me to come in at the end as a sort of if they're both disagreeing, I could say, well, actually I prefer that one. About three is that there's always a majority.
Rumour has it that Spielberg at some point got to see the Goodies and was rather taken.
Yes,
he did, just before he made 1941,
his
only comedy and his only flop.
He actually got his secretary to ring us up and would we be interested in making a film, a Goodies film with him. Well, we hesitated for a nanosecond. It was a wonderful thought. He was late at night watching us in Los Angeles, apparently.
Oh, he saw it on cable.
Yeah, as far as I'm concerned, it's like getting an award. The idea that Steven Spielberg even thought of making Goodies is terrific.
So, Graham, meanwhile, with the while through the 70s, the TV is going extremely well. You dropped I'm Sorry, I'll Read That Again, and substituted it, I suppose, luckily for many of us, with one of the all-time great radio shows. I'm Sorry, I Haven't a Clue. How did that come about?
Well, because we were moving into television and writing for television, writing for radio takes as long as writing for television and is paid a great deal less. It's also in many ways much harder. Every bit of it has to be dialogue and, the jokes have to work in a very restricted way. It's brilliant, great fun to do. But we found it was getting very difficult to earn a living and keep writing radio at the same time. So I went to David Hatch and said, why don't we do I'm Sorry, I'll Read That Again without a script? Because I'd been on a sort of panel game, I think, with Giles Brandreth, and thought, this is money for old Froome. You get people who are quite amusing, get them to play a silly game and just hope that they'll come up with something funny. So he said, all right, we'll try it. And we did a pilot. And Tim will vouch for it in the pub afterwards. We solemnly vowed, never again.
Too hard or hadn't worked?
Terrible. Terrible experience.
Oh. Really? Hum chaired it. I mean, so who was the team on that pilot?
Oh, John Cleese, was that?
Cleese, Bill Oddie, you
Joe Kemble was in. David Hatch, who had been, I'm sorry, that again.
Was producing that.
And he thought it was rubbish and took it to head of Radio 4, Tony Whitby, and said, I'm afraid this is no good. And Tony Whitby said, I like it, we'll have it on. And
so you were stuffed.
Yes, yes.
Now, where did Humph... Who cast Humph? Because, of course, Humph has
probably
become...
Probably you, wasn't it?
Well, I used to go in to see David Hatch as we graduated... Well, I sent in a sort of presentation of what I thought the show ought to be and the kind of rounds, some of which we still play. A lot of them have grown up over the years since then. And we talked about casting the chairman, and... Eventually, between us, we settled on Humphrey Lyttelton, who I think might have been David's idea. I mean,
unexpected but clever casting.
But he was a great broadcaster already, doing his jazz shows and things, and also a very witty, dry character. And I was delighted with the idea of that. And Barry Cryer, And between them, they hosted, I think, the first one.
I said Barry was a host in the early days.
Yeah. He was the chair, alternating with Humph. Yeah. Yeah.
Known, I suppose, as the antidote to panel games. Let's just remind ourselves why.
It's the quick-fire buzzer round now, teams. This needs little explanation from me, except to say that it's on the buzzer as ever, and it's quick-fire. Samantha's ready at the scoreboard, where, as usual, it'll be 1 point each or one away, otherwise it goes to the other side if not. So, fingers on buzzers. And Tim got his finger on the buzzer there first. 1 point, Tim. And on we go. So, fingers on buzzers. That was Barry. Okay, so the teams are now level pegging. Fingers on buzzers, please.
Humph.
I don't know who that was.
Is there something missing in this round?
Only Humph could make that possible.
Has it changed a lot over the years? Has it? I mean, we know small personnel changes, but as a show, has it changed?
Yes, it has. It's changed a great deal. Thanks. We have a very good producer, John Naismith, who is young and says, no, we can't do that. You did that last time. And we have to come up with new ideas for rounds each time. We miss Willie Rushton, of course, enormously.
I have to ask you one question, guys. What are the rules of Mornington Crescent?
Oh, for goodness sake. How old are you?
I sit there every week trying to...
The basic rules are very simple, but what we try and get a bit more advanced, obviously, otherwise it gets a bit boring if you just play the basic game.
So yeah, we play the Masters game.
Yeah. Mm.
Thank you for that answer.
Yeah.
Graham, of course, you've now moved on to capture a whole new audience with a new television departure in If I Ruled the World. How did that come about? Did you... invited to partake?
I was asked, and it seemed like a fun idea. What I find quite scary about it is that you get a bunch of comedians and put them in suits and get them to tell lies for half an hour, and they all look like politicians. No effort required.
Whereas comedy is accepted, or comedians are accepted to be liars, it's slightly worrying. Yes. When... Tim, I think you went on the first series.
Yes, I did.
You know the rules. So let me ask you, assuming that you did rule the world, what would be your first policy?
I think repeating the goodies. No surprise there.
Tim?
Well, I would like to take over as Director General of the BBC.
And what would be your first policy change there?
To repeat the goodies. Yeah.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much, Tim Brooke-Taylor and Graham Garden, from me, Paul Jackson. Good night.
Thank you very much.